This is Michael Harlan Turkel, host of The Food Scene. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Thank you so much for tuning in to the Heritage Radio Network. We are coming to you, as always, from the back of Roberta's Pizza. And tonight, we're thrilled to have you join us for a very special conversation on place and race in New York City. I'm your host tonight, Erin Fairbanks. I'm the executive director of the Heritage Radio Network and host of the Farm Report. And we are so thrilled to be joined in the studio and by phone with some of the foremost leaders in the New York City food space. The panel tonight was inspired by one of our reporters here at Heritage Radio Network, Yvette Cabrera. Yvette attended a talk put on by the New York City Food Forum entitled Why Equity Matters to the New York City Food System. And she pulled this panel together. And Yvette, I want to hand it over to you to introduce our esteemed panelists.
All right. Thank you. So the people we have on our panel tonight all have reputations that precede them. But I wanted to tell you a little bit about how they inspired us. So Karen Washington is a community gardener from the Bronx. She's also the co-founder of Black Urban Growers and has been called urban farming's de facto godmother. She inspired us with her passionate voice advocating for urban farmers and their need for access to land all over the country. And we also have Dennis Derrick, who is a professor of professional practice at the New School. He's also the founder of Corbin Hill, an organization that connects rural farmers and urban communities by providing fresh produce to residents of Harlem and the Bronx that's designed to meet the needs of low-income communities with flexible prices and culturally appropriate items. At the event, he spoke strongly about food justice and inclusion in the food system, alluding to organizations like his that are working to improve access to healthy foods by underserved communities.
So I would love to give both of you a chance to kind of kick us off by talking a little bit about this word equity. It's a word that I feel like often gets thrown around, and I'm wondering how you define it, what it means to you, and how your work is looking towards bringing more equity into the food systems of the greater New York area. Karen, why don't we have you kick us off?
Okay, so can you hear me? Because I'm all the way upstate at a conference. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you just fine.
Okay. So in terms of what I feel what equity is, it's really for me and for the people, for the underserved people, I think is leveling the playing area in such a way that everyone has equal access to food, to resources. It's something where there is no, where you don't want to see people fall below a certain criteria, a bottom line. And that's something that I work towards my work to make sure that everyone has a right to food that is local, that is affordable, and that is culturally appropriate. So equity, in my terms, is really people having equal access to food and resources.
Awesome. Dennis, how about for you?
For me, it is that also, but to me it's also about ownership. And essentially we're coming from such a wide divide and such incredible disparity that until we set the goal very high as to regards the community actually beginning to have the power to actually make decisions around policies and decisions around allocation of resources and to begin to own part and of the food system, we are just outside players in terms of thinking about equity. And so equity to me means we are really, truly players. And to do that, we have to be in the policy arena. We have to be, our voices need to be heard. And we have to be able to make decisions that impact on our community.
Well, both of you bring up a lot of points that I know we'll continue to discuss for the next hour. But Karen, I want to go back to you because one of the things you said in your definition there, food needs to be culturally appropriate. What does that mean and why is that important?
You know, if you look at the word agriculture, there is no agriculture without culture. And I think for too long, the emphasis around equity and around food has been getting food to people no matter how, no matter what. But I think the bottom line is that we have to take into consideration people's culture and ethnicity around food, and not everyone eats the same thing. So it's very important in terms of what we call food sovereignty, the ability for people to own their own land, their own business, to be able to control their own food system, but also to be able to grow food that is culturally appropriate in terms of tradition, and sometimes that's left out in the equation. And I think culture is extremely important in the food movement.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I just got the signal that we are joined by another guest on the phone tonight. So I'm actually going to have Yvette. I'm going to switch it back to you, Yvette, for make a quick introduction, and then we're going to continue our conversation. So go ahead.
All right. So tonight we also have Raymond Figueroa Reyes joining us. He's a longtime environmental activist and a community development consultant with Friends of Brook Park, a community-based environmental organization in the South Bronx that engages youth and adults in organic gardening, CSAs, arts, and the environment. He's also the founder of the Siembra Project, a project that earned the Innovators Award from Cornell University. And at the event, his voice resonated with us when he quoted Lila Watson saying, "If you're here to help me, you're wasting your time. But if you have come because your liberation is bound up with mine, then let us work together." Thanks for joining us, Ray.
Thank you for having me.
Ray, I want to give you a chance. The first question that we kicked off was talking about this idea of equity. And I'm wondering if you could share with our listeners, you know, what does equity mean to you? And how are you, in your work, you know, moving things towards a more equitable food system?
Well, equity, can you hear me?
Yeah, you're coming through loud and clear.
Okay, great. Yes, well, equity for me actually is not a, it's often equated with some form of parity, meaning let's get the underserved community up to the same level as the well-served community, if you will. The disadvantaged community coming up to the same level as the advantaged community. You know, some that the assumption is let's get that equity, that form of equality. Rather, for me, equity actually speaks more from a social justice perspective, and from a food justice perspective, and at that, from a food sovereignty perspective, where we're looking to honor the dignity of human beings to be productive in a way that they determine is good for them, and in a way that honors their sense of human dignity. And to be sure, I'm actually alluding to in those remarks to community gardening and urban farming, which does those three things: allows and facilitates people being productively engaged in a way that is self-determining, and finally in a way that honors their sense of human dignity. And for me, that's equity.
That makes a lot of sense and kind of ties into what Karen was speaking about earlier with regards to foods and access to foods that are culturally appropriate. Now, Dennis, I noticed on your website that that is something also that you shout out in your service provision when you're thinking about what types of products to provide the communities you serve. Can you talk about, you know, was that obvious to you from the start? Was it a learned lesson over the years? And how has that shaped your relationship with the farmers who grow the produce you bring into the Bronx and into Harlem?
Well, most of the design right now in terms of when we think traditionally about the farmers and community is really about what the farmers want to bring to the community. Here's what we have, and here's what we'll provide you. I call that the supply side approach. What I think we're really talking about is the demand side. And that is we're saying to the farmers, no, let's start with this. What can you grow the following items for us? Yes, there are items that you grow that we would want, but also it goes back to the cultural piece. So that, for instance, we spent 3 years working with farmers around the issue of growing something called callaloo. Well, we all know what callaloo is within our own particular community and very culturally relevant. Now, for the first time, they have been able to do that. We talk about cultural relevancy. We ask them, will you kindly grow okras for us? They're working at it. They haven't succeeded yet in bringing in a decent crop. But I think what we're really talking about from the cultural perspective is the fact that we are not sitting there simply from being supplied by food. We are also in the business of demanding what it is we want and asking farmers to grow it for us.
That makes a lot of sense. Karen, I know, you know, in a lot of communities, you know, you look around at what the food options are, and if you were to guess by what's there, it might seem like people are asking for, you know, McDonald's and Burger King and bodega food. And I think from your purview as a community gardener, you also see a demand for kind of other types of produce and products. And I'm wondering, how do we kind of reconcile what we're seeing on the ground and what we're kind of hearing that people want or are asking for? Where's the gap happening there? Why aren't these communities filled with...
I think the gap is happening in terms of education. It's, you know, when people talk about eradicating hunger and poverty, when they talk about getting people in low-income neighborhoods to eat more fruits and vegetables, we have to meet people where they are. It's been a long, long process of being inundated with processed food, where, you know, our narrative has been taken away in terms of people of color, how we used to grow our own food. And so getting people to realize that, first of all, growing food has been in our DNA from the beginning of time, that's number one. And number two, that our great-grandparents and our grandparents grew up on farms. They grew up on farms, so they knew where their food came from. And so we have this whole new group of people who don't know where their food comes from. And so as a result, they have been inundated with processed food. They've been inundated with the McDonald's and all the fast food restaurants and the processed food that has taken the place of good food. It's a slow process, but in my 13 years of running my farmer's market, people are starting to change. They're starting to now ask, especially when they're bringing their young children. And I think school gardens has been critical in terms of getting kids and getting agriculture back into the school. And so it's the children, it's the younger generation that are bringing their parents to the farmer's market asking, Mom, you know, we're not supposed to eat that. We're supposed to eat fresh carrots, or we're supposed to eat fresh vegetables. And I think that's where I see a turning point, is that the young people, the young generation are now getting on board and wanting food that is healthy and getting their parents to purchase food that is healthy.
Well, that kind of young people brings me kind of into my next point here, which is, you know, here at the Heritage Radio Network, we find we're inundated with young students and folks who are coming to the network wanting to get involved in the food movement. And they say often things like, you know, I really want to teach people how to eat better, and I really want to work with communities to increase food access. And, you know, my response to them is often kind of, you know, what do you even know about those things? And I'm wondering, Ray, if you can talk a little bit about kind of who should be bringing some of these lessons, as Karen said, like back to the community or into the community. Who should be teaching people kind of what to eat and how to cook? Like, where does that come from?
Well, that's an excellent question. First of all, when you have that type of thinking that you just alluded to, that is very otherwise very well-intentioned individuals operating on a very basic level that, okay, here are folks in need. One, you know, how can I help them eat better? How can I improve access? That actually implies a thinking that is very deficit-based, very deficit model-based, and it implies that folks don't have it within themselves, don't have the collective efficacy, the social capital, whereby to be productive on their own behalf. The reason why that is so significant is, as the research has shown, is that, for example, you just alluded to engaging young people in growing food via the school gardens. Actually, Karen mentioned that. When people grow their food, their own food, they tend to want to eat it. When people have an intimate relationship with farmers, and particularly with farmers at the hyper-local neighborhood level, food, you're creating social networks whereby folks are sharing. Folks are sharing culturally. They're sharing anecdotes about growing methods and all types of gardener stories. And in the process, food is being consumed as a result. So really, we have to come at this from looking at what is the existing social capital in the community, which is quite substantive, quite robust, particularly where you have community gardens present. And so that's just a plug for community gardens as a basis whereby to do the community development, which is really at the very heart of the so-called access issue. Really, community development issues are the issues of poverty. Community development issues are the issues of unemployment. If we could really, from our perspective, I know Karen and Dr. Derek shared this perspective, that when we approach the food access issue from a development economic, particularly an economic development perspective, we're really going to catalyze and galvanize a level of engagement at the very local neighborhood level that's going to redound and improve access to good nutrition. We're talking about food production, food processing, distribution, marketing at the very local neighborhood level, and we're developing communities in the process and circulating income in the process.
So, Dennis, kind of looking to you with that same question.
Yeah. You know, at the heart of what we're talking about here, in different, we're very close to saying the same thing. It's all about community building. And one of the things that goes back to your question about the numbers of people who come to you asking, can they do this and so forth, I think Ray also alludes to it, is the fact that the idea of vocabulary, I think, is so essential and so important that we have to almost, we at Corbin Hill, think of ourselves as kind of creating a vocabulary that's very different from what we hear in terms of the normal narrative. So that for us, for instance, it's important that we call folks shareholders. And in the process of calling folks shareholders, we're now implying that they're economic citizens, not just consumers. And so that becomes really important. Even the vocabulary, we call our folks community organizers. They're not outreach workers. We call them community chefs. They're not nutritionists. They happen to be community chefs who happen to also know about nutrition. And so this whole sense of thinking of this in terms of asset base, I think the vocabulary of what we use in the past is usually the kind of thing that I think is really detrimental. And goes back to much of what Ray and Karen both allude to.
So, Karen, kind of on that note of vocabulary, I'm wondering if that brings anything to mind for you. You know, you are obviously at a point in your career where you're working in a variety of spaces. And in some ways, I think acting as a translator between communities. And was hoping maybe you could talk a little bit about that type of work and what that brings up for you.
Well, I don't want to call myself like a translator. I want to get back to the point that when you ask what do people need in our community, I always tell people that we don't need people, outsiders, to come into our community to tell us what to do or how to translate. The leadership is already in our community. And I tell people, if you want to be able to come and help us, then share your resources, stand beside us, or look for the leadership that's already doing the work. So I find myself just a part of a growing movement of elders who are now passing the torch to the younger generation. I feel that I've opened a lot of doors. I created a lot of ways where people can now have a voice in the food movement. I'm no translator. I will, however, come out and defend some of the language that's used in our community in agriculture when it comes about organics, which sometimes can be very divisive. That's number one. And also the phrase food deserts, where we really have a problem with that term food desert. It's an outside term that has come in and really, really undermined the true problem in our community, which is hunger and poverty. And so if you talk about language, those are the types of language that I will speak out against. But in terms of speaking for other people, my job is to make sure that the leadership within my community has a platform and has a voice.
That makes a lot of sense. I guess, Ray, I would ask, you know, but, like, you know, I obviously used the word translator. Did I, like, totally Did I totally mess up here? What do you think?
No, I think your sensibilities, your intentions are genuine, and in that you are looking to, my sense is, how do we bridge, different worlds, if you will? How do we culturally bridge those worlds? That is to say, the community that is well-resourced, communities that are well-resourced, communities that are not as well-resourced, and how does that bridging happen? It happens via communication that Dennis and Karen have just so eloquently alluded to. So yes, maybe that's an education process for folks who are not indigenous to our communities, ongoing communication. I think the best thing is to come visit, sit a spell, spend some time, better yet, move into the community and live among folks and struggle together and work together and help to build community from the very ground up. Because to be sure, actions do speak louder than words. And when folks really begin to relate as human beings to one another, which doesn't happen in the constrained confines of a discrete, hey, I'm here to help you who need help relationship that's supported by some, grant that the so-called helper received, a so-called helping organization has just received. Those grants are very constrained. They're limited, one, financially, and two, they're limited in terms of time. The issues that we're speaking to that Derek picked up on very aptly are issues of community development. Community development, by its very nature, is a long-term enterprise. So if anything, I'm just going to hammer home that point that long-term community development is about addressing systemic issues of poverty and systemic issues of unemployment. We in the food sovereignty movement think we have a particular vision for how to address that, and in the process, improving the overall health and nutrition of people within our community. I looked before when I talked about something that I call micro food hub, to say at the very hyper neighborhood level, hyper local neighborhood level, getting integrating, vertically integrating the production, the value-added food processing, the distribution, storage, marketing, and all of that, so that we're really circulating, really maximizing the income circulation within a community. Remember that communities, if you look at, if you're familiar with Jane Jacobs' work, the community urbanist, the legendary urbanist, community yeah. urbanist, and so she really talked about in the death and life of cities, about local neighborhoods where you had the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker, the barber, and everybody in a community. Well, what I just alluded to from a micro food hub development perspective is just that. How do we begin to really economically and productively re-engage all of the aspects that make for a vital, for a revitalized, resilient community?
Yeah. So, Dennis, I think you are interesting in the fact that you work with the farmers, you work within the urban community, you do distribution, you also are an academic. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about who you see as, from a city perspective, like who are the players that kind of need to be at the table and be engaging to really affect change as it relates to increasing equity?
Well, you ask a very interesting question. And quite frankly, who needs to be at the table is the voice of the community. I mean, you say we have... I go to conference after conference, and I can count the number of people that look like me on both hands. I go to meetings where policy decisions are being made, major policy decisions, and By the time I get there, the decision has already been made. I sometimes wonder, why did I even bother to show up? So the question is, how do we get a seat at the table at a very early stage? There are some examples going on right now that I just think, you know, we have not been at the table, not consulted. Here's what these agencies decide, and this is what we are going to get. And their sense of equity is, you know, to me it's inequity because half of what they give us never fit us. And so in that regard, I know that Karen has been leading this battle for so long. You know, she's just one of my favorite. She's my hero in that sense. But who should be at the table? Voices from the community. I think there are a lot of grassroots voices that are just not even being recognized to come to that table. And one of the things that we're beginning to do at Corbin Hill is we've had two so far. We've had what we call conversations around community conversations around food. And this is very different. This is a community conversation taking place within our community. It is not something in which we find ourselves being invited and being the only, and as Malcolm X would say, there's nothing worse than being the only in that room. And so there's a willingness, there has to be a willingness on the part of all of these decision makers and the policy makers that they sincerely are not only interested in telling us their final decisions in which they're asking us to put blessings on it, but to simply say to us, listen, come here and we will make this omelet together and enjoy it together.
So I'm not sure for Ray or for Karen. I know that, you know, Barbara Turk was at the New York City Food Forum, and you know, I did hear from Yvette that she opened it up. She said, you know, I'm here, you know, tell me, talk to me. Karen, maybe starting with you, how do you respond to that? Like, how does that come across to you, and what, you know, what were your thoughts kind of walking away from that?
First of all, I love Barbara Turk. Really, really. I mean, I've known her several years. The fact that she is now in the Blasio administration, really working on policy, is absolutely excellent, because she's the type of person that wants to listen. She's not the type of person that's like, okay, this is my agenda, this is how we're going to do. And she reached out and said, tell me, let me know what you need. Let's sit down, let's talk about it. Let's engage. Let's see what we can do. And I think that is very important, especially from politicians, because for too long we have been relegated to just being, you know, non-entities. And I think hopefully with this new administration that they will see the role that community plays. And like Dennis and Ray both have been saying, it's about equity. It's about us being at the table. It's about us, the people who need the most, have a voice and a say in terms of what the solutions are. We don't need people telling us all the things that are wrong in our community. We know what's wrong with our community. What we need are solutions. We need solutions that take people out of poverty and hunger, put in jobs like Ray was saying about economic development, put them in jobs, let them own businesses like Derek is saying. Because once you start owning stuff, it gives you power. It gives you power to come out of poverty, to be able to feed yourself, to be able to own a home. And so when Barbara stood up and she said, talk to me, come to me, my door is open, that was a critical moment in New York City food policy. And I hope it continues. And I hope it continues. I hope that door is open throughout this administration, not only in terms of food, but policing, all community things that are happening, especially in the climate of what is happening in people of color in their communities. I just hope that that door is open down the chain of the Blasio administration.
Yeah, well, thinking about that climate in particular today with the release of the verdict on the Eric Garner case, I'm wondering, you know, Ray, how do folks, you know, when we think about food, I think there's oftentimes, as people are initially getting into it, this idea that food is like a topic that's discrete from other topics in our life. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about, you know, if you want to affect change in food, what are the other areas we need to be thinking about and working on?
Well, I just love the contextualization of that question. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Whether it's Michael Brown out in St. Louis, Eric Garner, and any number of our folk who have been violated, whose humanity has been violated, in this case, who have been killed. You know, this, again, we're talking about respecting the human dignity of all folks when we, as urban farmers, when we talk as community gardeners. And so let me just give, as it were, an analog discussion of community gardens. And I'll say this. Community gardens are very, very productive. You may be familiar with the work of Farm and Concrete. They produced 3 reports on, you know, harvest reports on the productivity of food productivity of community gardens. I highly commend that to you and to the listening audience. Farm and Concrete, they're on the web. You know, community gardens are very vibrant hubs promote community efficacy that leverage the community's human capital, in addition to buying all kinds of food. Well, there's such a garden like that, a community garden like that in Brooklyn. It's known as Boardwalk Community Garden. I don't know if you've heard of Boardwalk Community Garden. It's out in the tip of Brooklyn in the Coney Island area. Well, here's a community garden that's very vibrant in the ways that I just described, and really, you know, creating common ground for folks from all walks of life and all cultural backgrounds coming together and working collectively and collaboratively to feed themselves, their families, and by extension, the larger community. Well, do you know that community garden, in the height of its fecundity, in the height of its productivity, that community garden was bulldozed by the city of New York? Did you know that?
I wasn't aware, no.
Okay, so here is the policy misfit, if you will. We're talking about, Dennis, you know, you asked who needs to be at the table. Karen alluded to that. You know, we now have a food policy director, a beautiful, beautiful person in the person of Barbara Turk, whom I've had the privilege of meeting and talking with at length. But yet there is a policy misfit. For all of the glowing talk and of improving food access and urban ag and urban farming, and really, you know, localizing food, you know, food and nutrition improvements in where they're most needed. We have this misfit that structurally has to do with, you know, communities not being, as Dennis Derrick said, not being at the table. Or if we are at the table, we're only there in an advisory capacity. And I if you give me 30 seconds, I'll just run down this. One, at the community board level, where land decisions are being made, this particular community garden went, and the community garden voted with the people, said, oh, we're not going to have real estate development. We're going to promote this community garden and preserve this community garden. Well, that's great. Lots of folks came out. The community board voted with them. As you go up the decision-making chain in terms of the disposition of land resources here in the city, you have the City Planning Commission. Well, the City Planning Commission, I should backtrack and say that the community board's vote is advisory. The community board meets in the evening, which is good because folks in the community can come out, but its vote is advisory. When you get to the Planning Commission meets during the day when community folks cannot get out because of all of the realities, the day-to-day realities that they have to deal with as communities in struggle. And they can't get out to those meetings during the day. Yet the Planning Commission, who are individuals not elected, they are appointed individuals. They have power and sway and influence over the disposition of land resources. And in this case, the Planning Commission voted against the community garden, voted in behalf of real estate development. And then the City Council, when you go to the final level of the of decision making, the City Council, because it has such a plethora of legislation before it, operationally and functionally defers to the decision of the planning, the City Planning Commission. Again, when folks can't get out, that's when they vote. That's when the Planning Commission meets. And the Planning Commission is not made up of community folks. That's another problem. Dennis Derrick alluded to it. We need to have a Planning Commission that's reconstituted with urban agriculturalists, with environmentalists, with folks that really represent the true demographic diversity here in the city. So that's just a, you know, just a brief cursory structural analysis of what's going on from a governance perspective. In addition to which, I'll close by this, there's no zoning for community gardens. And so it's as if, you know, we know all that's going on, but when you get to the Planning Commission, it's like we're invisible. I think Karen or Dennis alluded to that invisibility earlier in their remarks. It's as if we don't exist. Community gardens look like vacant lots. So we have our work cut out for us. This is the policy work that we're engaged in to improve the regulatory regime by so that it is consistent with the rhetoric, so that, you know, we are walking the walk and not just talking the talk. And that's where we're at right now in terms of the art of urban agriculture, particularly as they impact communities of color, working class communities of color.
Well, thank you for sharing like such a specific example, because I think that's a lot of the components that you touch on there are things that, like, you hear about, oh, this system doesn't work, or it disenfranchises folks, or, you know, it's not set up. And it's hard to understand kind of where along the chain those things are happening. Dennis, did you want to jump in there?
Yeah, I think one of the things that we deal with all of these contradictions that we're really throwing out there. For instance, on one hand, you can say that our community, given the income disparities, has been an extraordinarily resilient community. As economic citizens, these low-income folks make incredibly brilliant decisions. You know, if they have to make a choice between paying the rent or purchasing food, they would decide to pay the rent so that they're not homeless. Whereas the choice is, you know, as one doctor said to me, he never really thought about low-income folks really making tough economic decisions. And I said, well, you know, given your income, the decisions that you make are very, very different from someone who is, you know, in our communities where 60-something percent in the South Bronx make less than 200% of the poverty household income. These are the kinds of things that our folks are very, very resilient. And it's one thing to say, well, you know, we're in this food swamp and we have to eat all of this, the stuff that's here. Well, they have to make some tough, tough choices in terms of their family, in terms of their existence. And to me, we don't give our community enough credit in terms of their resiliency, given the disparities in income. And the disparities in income is something that I think we have to understand structurally, with the impact it's having on our community at every single level. For instance, if you take something like the South Bronx, 32% of the people in the South Bronx pay close to 53% of their gross income on rent. Okay, so that we can talk about all of these issues about living wage and so forth. But quite frankly, after you've taken a look at the living wage and you realize how rent poor they are and what little money is left, you begin to understand that that's just the beginning, the tip of the iceberg in terms of what we need to address in our community. It is not simply just about a living wage. It's about wealth. If you take a look at the examples, for instance, of the more recent report that just came out called Beyond Broke, it turns out that the median liquid assets for blacks is less than $300. You know, I say to my staff, why do you think there's a pawn shop next to our office? Because if you have to cash in your assets, that's about the limit of where you would have to go, because you're not going to a bank and you're not going to some savings account, and you don't have necessarily have the access in terms of family with great wealth. And so the issue is not just the living wage, it's about the wealth. The issue also is the understanding of the resiliency of our community, and given the disparities with which they live and continue to live and actually have not given up.
I want to shift gears a little bit with the little bit of time that we have left, and kind of come back again to this idea of come back to this idea of education. You know, we had a visit here earlier in the studio from the folks at the University Gastronomica in Italy. And one of the things that they were saying that really rang true to me is across the globe, and in particular across the country, we're seeing a rise of food studies programs at the undergraduate and the graduate level. And one of the things that I think is very exciting about that is it's reflective of a lot of energy and enthusiasm for folks to kind of engage in work around food. And I wonder if I could go through and ask each of you, you know, what are the important classes that should be built into this curriculum? How do we kind of rethink the pedagogy around the way we're teaching people to think about food and food systems? And Karen, maybe we'll start with you.
I think the most important thing that needs to be taught in curriculum is culture and social justice. I mean, because it's so easy to put in a curriculum, how do you grow food, how do you plant? But I think to have that conversation, first of all, storytelling. Mm-hmm. I think history around where food comes from, history as it relates to culture and tradition. You know, I go to so many workshops and conferences, and no one ever mentions George Washington Carver. George Washington Carver was like the father of agriculture. He is never mentioned on the lips of agriculture. So we need to sit down and within curriculum, talk about the history of agriculture, talk about do storytelling, talk about how food relates to culture, talk about how people came to this country with seeds in their hair and planted seeds to grow crops of rice. A lot of our history has been taken away from us, and we need to have that narrative told within the curriculum of food. Culture is important. Tradition is important. How you can grow food, that's the easiest test that can be taught. But what's missing within the dynamics of agriculture is the social and the cultural aspect. We need to have those stories told so that the younger generation know the impact of their people in the agricultural system.
Karen, thank you so much. Ray, how about you? What's on your kind of hit list as far as a curriculum development goes?
Well, earlier this year in the spring semester, I was at Marion Nessel's class. She has a graduate class in food policy, and I was a guest presenter. And I took the entire period to discuss what I just had alluded to you earlier. That is to say, Karen hit the nail on the head when she alluded to culture and when she alluded to social justice and to storytelling. In other words, how do we really humanize the subject matter of food systems and policy? How do we really put a human face on it? I just wanted to say, this is totally not your question, but just to close the loop on your previous question, Eric Garner was an individual that was killed, and Boardwalk Community Garden was a community that was killed. And so, you know, the injustices that we're facing, the violence that we're facing as a community, structural violence on the one hand, and then violence by the police on another, it's violence because it's disrespecting the fundamental humanity of us. And that really is a feature of racism. And we just have to really look at it. We have to have sobering discussions on racism in this country. So that would be a curriculum chapter, if you will, in the syllabus, that needs to be addressed. And then, you know, what I, you know, a favorite area of mine is just doing what I call structural analysis. And, where you really just take apart the nuts and bolts of how, and from my perspective, how governance and decision-making happens. And to be sure, there are actually some bright lights. I love that Dennis Derrick said, you know, our community is resilient in the face of, in spite of. And, you know, there's a very exciting initiative going on in the city that really speaks to participatory democracy. This is what we're talking about. Individuals whose lives are affected in consequential ways by the structure of governance, they need to be involved in the active participation of the decisions of those structures of governance. And so what we have that's really exciting in the city is something called participatory budgeting. And I'll just leave it at that. But it's where local officials, city council members, have deferred let's just say $1 million pot of money out of their discretionary capital fund to the community and let the community decide. How can we expand upon that model so that we can have participatory democracy in the form of participatory urban planning at the planning commission and on and on and on? So, you know, pushing the models of democracy, particularly democratic governance models such as participatory budgeting. So those would be my suggestions.
And then I guess we'll end up, with you, Dennis.
Yeah, the social justice piece, I think, is important. I think specifically around the issue of food justice. I think that when we talk about a socially just food system, you know, very few voices you hear about in terms of the farmer or the farm worker, I should start off with. They're just not there. They're just not represented. We just don't understand. I mean, say the laws that govern the farm worker are absurd. If you really got into it, I think there's a need to really understand that we're talking about a system. And you know, while we in our community are struggling to get a voice, the farm worker basically is also being left out. So that one of the things, you know, we go around and people. I left a meeting recently in which everybody was saying, you know, we've got to get prices of the food such that people can afford it. And I said, well, fine. What does that mean? Are you going to give less, or are you going to charge, give less in terms of the number of items that you want to include? Because that's the only way you can do it. I mean, you say, who in that chain are you really beginning to ignore and to not reflect them as part of that chain? And I think that this whole idea of food justice begins with the farm worker and ends with us in our community as we decide what it is we would like to eat. And I think in that process, somehow or the other, we just don't understand what that full chain means when we talk about food justice.
And I think we have time for one more question from everyone, and I want to leave it a little bit open. But I guess one of the things I'm also curious about is, you know, if there's one thing, one big thing, and maybe one small thing that would help you in your work, I wonder if you can share with us, big picture, what would help, but also, is there like a small, you know, takeaway item that you're like, man, this just burns my buttons, and it'd be nice to have. And maybe, Dennis, we'll switch the loop around and we'll start with you this time.
Well, the one thing that I have really kind of learned and really has helped us a great deal is the fact that even when we use the word community, we actually have a number of communities within our community. And all of them suffer from different kind of barriers or disparities. I think of the ex-offenders who have absolutely no access to SNAP. I think of the mothers who are coming out of prison, not only not having any access, but they have no access to housing. If they don't find housing in 6 months, they lose custody of their kids if they're in foster care. And I think about us really talking about community. We have so many communities within our community that's not even part of this discussion. I think of the 26,000 people suffering from HIV and AIDS in the South Bronx and Harlem. They're not at the table. I think of places like the Fortune Society and the ex-offenders, those formerly incarcerated, who are just not at the table. And I could go on and on and on about these particular, the formerly homeless. They're just not at the table. And I'm saying that, quite frankly, we've got a long way to go in terms of folks from the outside understanding our different communities within our community.
Thank you for that. Ray, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Thank you. I'm going to actually pick up where Dennis left off at my base of operation in the South Bronx at Friends of Brook Park. We have an alternatives to incarceration program for court adjudicated as well as formerly incarcerated youth. A number of these youth literally are food insecure. You know, so if you're talking about You know, how can a young person, how does a young person get into the predicament that they're in? In this case, you know, being arrested, being touched by the criminal justice system. Well, you know, it's connected to the fact that they're not eating. How many households do I have? Too many, wherein the young people at home, they're fighting over food. This is happening right now as I'm speaking to you, that there is not, that there's literally a fundamental issue around hunger and food insecurity. And it's really being played out in this demographic cohort that Dennis just alluded to. So I would love to improve opportunities and expand our alternatives to incarceration program. That would be the small thing. The larger thing, two larger things. I'm actually working with the Barred Prison Initiative, and we're now in discussions on how to develop reentry based on urban agricultural internships for individuals coming out of prison. Barred College runs a college and prison program in upstate New York, and I've had the privilege of presenting at one of the correctional facilities in upstate. So I'm really excited about that. And then finally, I would say, you know, budgeting is an exercise in prioritizing. And so, you know, increasing participatory budgeting regime. Why? Because in the Bronx, we were able to leverage participatory budgeting to the tune of over $250,000 for the construction of a food production greenhouse on NYCHA public housing land. So, you know, how do we, and that was voted on by local folks who said, hey, we got this opportunity to vote on things that we think are going to be good for our community, that are going to employ our youth. This is what we want to see. And so that those would be my three, actually.
Thank you so much, Ray. Karen?
Yeah, so my big thing is, so Warren Buffett, are you out there listening? I hope you're listening to this radio program, because I want you to come into my community and spread your money for financial literacy. That's number one.
Wow.
Also for economic development and growth. I don't want people to come into my community again with another program, food stamps, another program of food pantries, soup kitchens. Come into my community, Warren Buffett and everyone else. Come in our community with job creation and business opportunities and financial literacy. The only way we're going to really put a dent in the hunger and poverty in my community is through economic development. So Warren Buffett, you're out there. I got a big wish. Come to my community, and all those who have resources, come into our community with job creation and economic development and entrepreneurship. That's my big thing. My small thing is that we run a program called Farm School, the New York School of Urban Agriculture, that just lost its USDA grant. However, we have now moved forward so that the membership at large are participating in making sure this school continues. So, y'all are out there. IOB is the crowdfunding platform. Give to New York City Community, so New York School of Urban Agriculture, Farm School, NYC, because it touches everybody. It's a school that was built on the backs of grassroots organizing, and it's a way, it's an opportunity for people to learn how to grow food from the likes of Dr. Dennis Derricks, from the likes of my presidente, Ray Figueroa, from the likes of all the grassroots organizing people who want to see food justice and want to see justice for all. Those are my two wishes.
Wow. I just have to say thank you to all of you, Raymond, Dennis, Karen. It's been such an honor to have you join us in conversation, and we're hopeful that we'll get a chance to do this again soon and often. I would really love to be a resource here at the Radio Network to share all of the great work you're doing. Thank you so much for joining us.
Love you,
it's
Dennis.
Been a real pleasure. Thank you.
I also have to give a big
shout out. Thank you, Karen. Thank you, Dennis.
Take care, Ray.
I have to also share a big thank you for the producer on this series, Yvette Cabrera, who really brought it to life. And I want to direct people towards the NYC Food Forum website, www.nycfoodforum.org, a great place to check out and explore further conversation on these issues and more. And a big shout out to our engineer tonight, Jack Inslee, in the studio there. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. This has been a special episode from the Heritage Radio Network. We appreciate your support and stay tuned in.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.